Welcome to this week's Classic Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Vintage Short Fiction, Volume 1, edited by Dave Madden. Going to Meet the Man by James Baldwin. What's the matter? She asked. I don't know, he said, trying to laugh. I guess I'm tired. You've been working too hard, she said. I'm keep telling you. Well, goddamn it, woman, he said. It's not my fault. He tried again. He wretchedly failed again. Then he just lay there, silent, angry, and helpless. Excitement filled him like a toothache, but it refused to enter his flesh. He stroked her breast. This was his wife. He could not ask her to do just a little thing for him, just to help him out, just for a little while, the way he could ask a nigger girl to do it. He lay there, and he sighed. The image of a black girl caused a distant excitement in him, like a faraway light. But again, the excitement was more like pain. Instead of forcing him to act, it made action impossible. Go to sleep, she said gently. You got a hard day tomorrow. Yeah, he said, and rolled over on his side, facing her, one hand still on one breast. God damn the niggers, the black stinking coons. You think they'd learn? Wouldn't you think they'd learn? I mean, wouldn't you? They're going to be out there tomorrow, she said, and took his hand away. Get some sleep. He lay there, one hand between his legs, staring at the frail sanctuary of his wife. A faint light came from the shutters. The moon was full. Two dogs, far away, were barking at each other, back and forth, insistently, as though they were agreeing to make an appointment. He heard a car coming north on the road, and he half sat up, his hand reaching for his holster, which was on a chair near the bed on top of his pants. The lights hit the shutters and seemed to travel across the room and then went out. The sound of the car slipped away. He heard it hit gravel, then heard it no more. Some liver-lipped students, probably heading back to that college, but coming from where? His watch said it was 2 a.m. They could be coming from anywhere, from out of state most likely, and they would be at the courthouse tomorrow. The niggers were getting ready. Well, they would be ready, too. He moaned. He wanted to let whatever was in him out, but it couldn't come out. God damn, he said aloud, and turned again, on his side, away from Grace, staring at the shutters. He was a big, healthy man, and he never had any trouble sleeping. And he wasn't old enough yet to have any trouble getting it up. He was only 42. And he was a good man, a God-fearing man. He had tried to do his duty all his life, and he had been a deputy sheriff for several years. Nothing had ever bothered him before, certainly not getting it up. Sometimes, sure, like any other man, he knew that he wanted a little more spice than Grace could give him, and he would drive over yonder and pick up a black piece or arrest her. It came to the same thing. But he couldn't do that now no more. There was no telling what might happen once your ass was in the air. And they were low enough to kill a man then, too, every one of them, or the girl herself might do it, right while she was making believe you made her feel so good. The niggers. What had the good Lord Almighty had in mind when he made the niggers? Well, they were pretty good at that, all right. Damn, damn, goddamn. This wasn't helping him to sleep. He turned again toward Grace again and moved close to her warm body. He felt something he had never felt before. He felt that he would like to hold her, hold her, hold her, and be buried in her like a child, and never have to get up in the morning again and go downtown to face those faces. Good Christ, they were ugly. And never have to enter that jailhouse again and smell that smell and hear that singing. Never again feel that filthy, kinky, greasy hair under his hand. Never again watch those black breasts leap against the leaping cattle prod. Never hear those moans again or watch that blood run down, or the fat lips split, or the sealed eyes struggle open. They were animals. They were no better than animals. What could be done with people like that? Here they had been in a civilized country for years, and they still lived like animals. Their houses were dark, with oilcloth or cardboard in the windows. The smell was enough to make you puke your guts out, and there they sat, a whole tribe, pumping out kids, it looked like every damn 5 minutes, and laughing and talking and playing music like they didn't have a care in the world. And he reckoned they didn't, neither. And coming to the door, into the sunlight, just standing there, just looking foolish, not thinking of anything, but just getting back to what they were doing, saying, "Yes, sir, Mr. Jesse. I surely will, Mr. Jesse. Fine weather, Mr. Jesse. Why, I thank you, Mr. Jesse." He had worked for a mail order house for a while, and it had been his job to collect the payments for the stuff they bought. They were too dumb to know that they were being cheated blind, but that was no skin off his ass. He was just supposed to do his job. They would be late. They didn't have the sense to put money aside, but it was easy to scare them, and he never really had any trouble. Hell, they liked him. The kids used to smile when he came to the door. He gave them candy sometimes, or chewing gum, and rubbed their rough bullet heads. Maybe the candy should have been poisoned. Those kids were grown now. He had had trouble with one of them today. There was this nigger today, he said, and stopped. His voice sounded peculiar. He touched Grace. You awake? He asked. She mumbled something impatiently. She was probably telling him to go to sleep. It was all right. He knew that he was not alone. What a funny time, he said, to be thinking about a thing like that. You listening? She mumbled something again. He rolled over on his back. This nigger's one of the ringleaders. We had trouble with him before. We must have had him out there at the work farm 3 or 4 times. Well, Big Jim C. and some of the boys really had to whip that nigger's ass today. He looked over at Grace. He could not tell whether she was listening or not, and he was afraid to ask again. They had this line, you know, to register. He laughed, but she did not. And they wouldn't stay where Big Jim C. wanted them. No, they had to start blocking traffic all around the courthouse, so couldn't nothing or nobody get through. And Big Jim C. told them to disperse, and they wouldn't move. They just kept up that singing. And Big Jim C. figured that the others would move, that this nigger would move, him being the ringleader. But he wouldn't move, and he wouldn't let the others move. So they had to beat him and a couple of others, and they threw them in the wagon. But I didn't see this nigger till I got to the jail. They were still singing, and I was supposed to make them stop. Well, I couldn't make them stop for me, but I knew he could make them stop. He was lying there on the ground, jerking and moaning. They had threw him in a cell by himself, and blood was coming out of his ears from where Big Jim C. and his boys had whipped him. Wouldn't you think they'd learn? I put the prod to him, and he jerked some more, and he kind of screamed, but he didn't have much voice left. You make them stop that singing, I said to him. You hear me? You make them stop that singing. He acted like he didn't hear me, and I put it to him again and under his arms, and he just rolled around on the floor, and blood started coming from his mouth. He'd pissed his pants already. He paused. His mouth felt dry, and his throat was as rough as sandpaper. As he talked, he began to hurt all over with that peculiar excitement which refused to be released. You all are going to stop your singing, I said to him, and you're going to stop coming down to the courthouse and disrupting traffic and molesting the people and keeping us from our duties and keeping doctors from getting to sick white women and getting all of them, northerners in this town, to give our town a bad name. As he said this, he kept prodding the boy, sweat pouring from beneath the helmet he had not yet taken off. The boy rolled around in his own dirt and water and blood and tried to scream again as the prod hit his testicles, but the scream did not come out. Only a kind of rattle and a moan. He stopped. He was not supposed to kill the nigger. The cell was filled with a terrible odor. The boy was still. You hear me? He called. You had enough? The singing went on. You had enough? His foot leapt out. He had not known it was going to and caught the boy flush on the jaw. Jesus, he thought, this ain't no nigger. This is a goddamn bull. And he screamed again. You had enough? You're going to make them stop singing now? But the boy was out, and now he was shaking worse than the boy had been shaking. He was glad no one could see him. At the same time, he felt very close to a very peculiar, particular joy. Something deep in him and deep in his memory was stirred, but whatever was in his memory eluded him. He took off his helmet. He walked to the cell door. White man, said the boy from the floor behind him. He stopped. For some reason, he grabbed his privates. You remember old Julia? The boy said from the floor with his mouth full of blood and one eye barely open, glaring like the eye of a cat in the dark. My grandmother's name was Mrs. Julia Blossom. Mrs. Julia Blossom. You going to call our women by their right names yet? And those kids ain't going to stop singing. We going to keep on singing until every one of you miserable white mothers go stark raving out of your minds. Then he closed the one eye. He spat blood. His head fell back against the floor. He looked down at the boy whom he had been seeing off and on for more than a year and suddenly remembered him. Old Julia had been one of his mail order customers, a nice old woman. He had not seen her for years. He supposed that she must be dead. He had walked into the yard. The boy had been sitting in a swing. He had smiled at the boy and asked, "Old Julia home?" The boy looked at him for a long time before he answered, "Don't know old Julia live here." "This is her house. I know her. She's lived here for years." The boy shook his head. "You might know an old Julia somewhere else, white man, but don't nobody by that name live here." He watched the boy. The boy watched him. The boy certainly wasn't more than 10. White man. He didn't have time to be fooling around with some crazy kid. He yelled, "Hey, old Julia!" But only silence answered him. The expression on the boy's face did not change. The sun beat down on them both, still and silent. He had the feeling that he'd been caught up in a nightmare dreamed by a child, perhaps one of the nightmares he himself had dreamed as a child. It had that feeling, everything familiar, without undergoing any other change, had been subtly and hideously displaced. The trees, the sun, the patches of grass in the yard, the leaning porch and the weary porch steps, and the cardboard in the windows, and the black hole of the door which looked like the entrance to a cave, and the eyes of the pickaninny, all were charged with malevolence. "White man," he looked at the boy. "She's gone out?" The boy said nothing. "Well," he said, "tell her I passed by, and I'll pass by next week." He started to go. He stopped. "You want some chewing gum?" The boy got down from the swing and started for the house. He said, "I don't want nothing you got, white man." He walked into the house and closed the door behind him. Now the boy looked as though he were dead. Jesse wanted to go over to him and pick him up and pistol whip him until the boy's head burst open like a melon. He began to tremble with what he believed was rage, sweat, both cold and hot, raced down his body. The singing filled him as though it was a weird, uncontrollable, monstrous howling rumbling up from the depths of his own belly. He felt an icy fear rise in him and raise him up, and he shouted, he howled, "You lucky we pump some white blood into you every once in a while, you're women. Here's what I got for all the black bitches in the world." Then he was abruptly, almost too weak to stand. To his bewilderment, his horror, beneath his own fingers, he felt himself violently stiffen, with no warning at all. He dropped his hands, and he stared at the boy, and he left the cell. "All that singing they do," he said, "all that singing." He could not remember the first time he had heard it. He'd been hearing it all his life. It was a sound with which he was most familiar, though it was also the sound of which he had been least conscious, and it had always contained an obscure comfort. They were singing to God. They were singing for mercy, and they hoped to go to heaven, and he had even sometimes felt, when looking into the eyes of some of the old women, a few of the very old men, that they were singing for mercy for his soul, too. Of course he had never thought of their heaven, or what God was or could be for them. God was the same for everyone, he supposed, and heaven was where good people went, he supposed. He had never thought much about what it meant to be a good person. He tried to be a good person and treat everybody right. It wasn't his fault if the niggers had taken into their heads to fight against God and go against the rules laid down in the Bible for everyone to read. Any preacher would tell you that. He was only doing his duty, protecting white people from the niggers and the niggers from themselves. And there were still lots of good niggers around. He had to remember that. They weren't all like that boy this afternoon, and the good niggers must be mighty sad to see what was happening to their people. They would thank him when this was over. In that way they had, the best of them, not quite looking him in the eye, in a low voice, with a little smile. "We surely thanks you, Mr. Jesse. From the bottom of our hearts we thanks you." He smiled. They hadn't all gone crazy. This trouble would pass. He knew that the young people had changed some of the words to the songs. He had scarcely listened to the words before, and he did not listen to them now, but he knew that the words were different. He could hear that much. He did not know if the faces were different. He had never, before this trouble began, watched them as they sang, but he certainly did not like what he saw now. They hated him, and this hatred was blacker than their hearts, blacker than their skins, redder than their blood, and harder by far than his club. Each day, each night, he felt worn out, aching with their smell in his nostrils and filling his lungs as though he were drowning, drowning in niggers, and it was all to be done again when he woke. It would never end. It would never end. Perhaps this was what the singing had meant all along. They had not been singing black folks into heaven. They had been singing white folks into hell. Everyone felt this black suspicion in many ways, but no one knew how to express it. Men much older than he, who had been responsible for law and order much longer than he, were now much quieter than they had been, and the tone of their jokes, in a way he could not quite put his finger on, had changed. These men were his models. They had been friends to his father, and they'd taught him what it meant to be a man. He looked to them for courage now. It wasn't that he didn't know that what he was doing was right. He knew that. Nobody had to tell him that. It was only that he missed the ease of former years. But they didn't have much time to hang out with each other these days. They tended to stay close to their families every free minute because nobody knew what might happen next. Explosions rocked the night of their tranquil town. Each time, each man wondered silently if perhaps this time the dynamite had not fallen into the wrong hands. They thought they knew where all the guns were, but they could not possibly know every move that was made in that secret place where the darkies lived. From time to time, it was suggested that they form a posse and search the home of every nigger, but they hadn't done it yet. For one thing, this might have brought the bastards from the north down on their backs. For another, although the niggers were scattered throughout the town, down in the hollow near the railroad tracks, way west near the mills, up on the hill, the well-off ones, and some out near the college, nothing seemed to happen in one part of town without the niggers immediately knowing it in the other. This meant that they could not take them by surprise. They rarely mentioned it, but they knew that some of the niggers had guns. It stood to reason, as they said, since, after all, some of them had been in the army. There were niggers in the army right now, and God knows they wouldn't have had any trouble stealing this half-assed government blind. The whole world was doing it. Look at the European countries and all those countries in Africa. They made jokes about it, bitter jokes, and they cursed the government in Washington, which had betrayed them, but they had not yet formed a posse. Now, if their town had been laid out like some towns in the north, where all the niggers lived together in one locality, they could have gone down and set fire to the houses and brought about peace that way. If the niggers had all lived in one place, they could have kept the fire in one place. But the way this town was laid out, the fire could hardly be controlled. It would spread all over town, and the niggers would probably be helping it to spread. Still, from time to time, they spoke of doing it anyway. So that now there was a real fear among them that somebody might go crazy and light the match. They rarely mentioned anything not directly related to the war that they were fighting, but this had failed to establish between them the unspoken communication of soldiers during a war. Each man in the thrilling silence which sped outward from their exchanges, their laughter and their anecdotes, seemed wrestling in various degrees of darkness with a secret which he could not articulate to himself, and which, however directly it related to the war, related yet more surely to his privacy and his past. They could no longer be sure, after all, that they had all done the same things. They had never dreamed that their privacy could contain any element of terror, could threaten, that is, to reveal itself, to the scrutiny of a judgment day, while remaining unreadable and inaccessible to themselves. Nor had they dreamed that the past, while certainly refusing to be forgotten, could yet so stubbornly refuse to be remembered. They felt themselves mysteriously set at naught, as no longer entering into the real concerns of other people, while here they were, outnumbered, fighting to save the civilized world. They had thought that people would care. People didn't care, not enough anyway, to help them. It would have been a help, really, or at least a relief, even to have been forced to surrender. This they had lost, probably forever, their old and easy connection with each other. They were forced to depend on each other more and at the same time to trust each other less. Who could tell when one of them might not betray them all for money or for the ease of confession? But no one dared imagine what there might be to confess. They were soldiers fighting a war. But their relationship to each other was that of accomplices in a crime. They all had to keep their mouths shut. I stepped in the river at Jordan. Out of the darkness of the room, out of nowhere, the line came flying up at him with the melody and the beat. He turned wordlessly toward his sleeping wife. I stepped in the river at Jordan. Where had he heard that song? Grace, he whispered, you awake? She did not answer. If she was awake, she wanted him to sleep. Her breathing was slow and easy. Her body slowly rose and fell. I stepped in the river at Jordan. The water came to my knees. He began to sweat. He felt an overwhelming fear, which yet contained a curious and dreadful pleasure. I stepped in the river at Jordan. The water came to my waist. It had been night, as it was now. He was in the car between his mother and father, sleepy, his head in his mother's lap, sleepy and yet full of excitement. The singing came from far away, across the dark fields. There were no lights anywhere. They had said goodbye to all the others and turned off on this dark dirt road. They were almost home. I stepped in the river at Jordan. The water came over my head. I looked way over to the other side. He was making up my dying bed. I guess they singing for him, his father said, seeming very weary and subdued now. Even when they sad, they sound like they just about to go and tear off a piece. He yawned and leaned across the boy and slapped his wife lightly on the shoulder, allowing his hand to rest there for a moment. Don't they? Don't talk that way, she said. Well, that's what we're going to do, he said. You can make up your mind to that. He started whistling. You see, when I begin to feel it, I gets kind of musical, too. Oh, Lord, come on and ease my troubling mind. He had a black friend his age, 8, who lived nearby. His name was Otis. They wrestled together in the dirt. Now the thought of Otis made him sick. He began to shiver. His mother put her arm around him. He's tired, she said. We'll be home soon, said his father. He began to whistle again. We didn't see Otis this morning, Jesse said. He did not know why he said this. His voice in the darkness of the car sounded small and accusing. You haven't seen Otis for a couple of mornings, his mother said. That was true, but he was only concerned about this morning. No, his father said. I reckon Otis's folks was afraid to let him show himself this morning. But Otis didn't do nothing. Now his voice sounded questioning. Otis can't do nothing, his father said. He's too little. The car lights picked up their wooden house, which now solemnly approached them, the lights falling around it like yellow dust. Their dog, chained to a tree, began to bark. We just wanted to be sure Otis don't do nothing, said his father, and stopped the car. He looked down at Jesse. And you tell him what your daddy said, you hear? Yes, sir, he said. His father switched off the lights. The dog moaned and pranced, but they ignored him and went inside. He could not sleep. He lay awake, hearing the night sounds, the dog yawning and moaning outside, the sawing of the crickets, the cry of the owl, dogs barking far away, then no sounds at all, just the heavy, endless buzzing of the night. The darkness pressed on his eyelids like a scratchy blanket. He turned again. He wanted to call his mother, but he knew his father would not like this. He was terribly afraid. Then he heard his father's voice in the other room, low, with a joke in it, but this did not help him. It frightened him more. He knew what was going to happen. He put his head under the blanket, then pushed his head out again, for fear, staring at the dark window. He heard his mother's moan, his father's sigh. He gritted his teeth. Then their bed began to rock. His father's breathing seemed to fill the world. That morning, before the sun had gathered all its strength, men and women, some flushed and some pale with excitement, came with the news. Jesse's father seemed to know what the news was before the first jalopy stopped in the yard and he ran out crying, "They got him then? They got him?" The first jalopy held 8 people, 3 men and 2 women and 3 children. The children were sitting on the laps of the grown-ups. Jesse knew 2 of them, the 2 boys. They shyly and uncomfortably greeted each other. He did not know the girl. "Yes, they got him," said one of the women, the older one, who wore a wide hat and a fancy faded blue dress. "They found him early this morning." "How far had he got?" Jesse's father asked. "He hadn't got no further than Harkness," one of the men said. "Looked like he got lost up there in all them trees, or maybe he just got so scared he couldn't move." They all laughed. "Yes, and you know it's near a graveyard, too," said the younger woman, and they laughed again. "Is that where they got him now?" asked Jesse's father. By this time, there were 3 cars piled behind the first one, with everyone looking excited and shining, and Jesse noticed that they were carrying food. It was like a 4th of July picnic. "Yeah, that's where he is," said one of the men. "Declare, Jesse, you're going to keep us here all day long answering your damn fool questions? Come on, we ain't got no time to waste. Don't bother putting up no food, cried a woman from one of the cars. We got enough. Just come on. Why, thank you, said Jesse's father. We'd be right along then. I'd better get a sweater for the boy, said his mother, in case it turns cold. Jesse watched his mother's thin legs cross the yard. He knew that she also wanted to comb her hair a little and maybe put on a better dress, the dress she wore to church. His father guessed this, too, for he yelled behind her, Now don't you go trying to turn yourself into no movie star. You just come on. But he laughed as he said this and winked at the men. His wife was younger and prettier than most of the other women. He clapped Jesse on the head and started pulling him toward the car. You all go on, he said. I'll be right behind you. Jesse, you go tie up that there dog while I get this car started. The car sputtered and coughed and shook. The caravan began to move. Bright dust filled the air. As soon as he was tied up, the dog began to bark. Jesse's mother came out of the house, carrying a jacket for his father and a sweater for Jesse. She had put a ribbon in her hair and had an old shawl around her shoulders. Put these in the car, son, she said, and handed everything to him. She bent down and stroked the dog, looked to see if there was water in his bowl, then went back up the three porch steps and closed the door. Come on, said father, ain't nothing in there for nobody to steal. He was sitting in the car, which trembled and belched. The last car of the caravan had disappeared, but the sound of singing floated behind them. Jesse got into the car, sitting close to his father, loving the smell of the car, and the trembling, and the bright day, and the sense of going on a great and unexpected journey. His mother got in and closed the door, and the car began to move. Not until then did he ask, Where are we going? Are we going on a picnic? He had a feeling that he knew where they were going, but he was not sure. That's right, his father said. We're going on a picnic. And you won't ever forget this picnic. Are we, he asked after a moment, going to see the bad nigger, the one that knocked down old Miss Standish? Well, I reckon, said his mother, that we might see him. He started to ask, Will a lot of niggers be there? Will Otis be there? But he did not ask his question, to which, in a strange and uncomfortable way, he already knew the answer. Their friends and their other cars stretched up the road as far as he could see. Other cars had joined them. There were cars behind them. They were singing. The sun seemed suddenly very hot, and he was at once very happy and a little afraid. He did not quite understand what was happening, and he did not know what to ask. He had no one to ask. He had grown accustomed for the solution of such mysteries to go to Otis. He felt that Otis knew everything. But he could not ask Otis about this. Anyway, he had not seen Otis for 2 days. He had not seen a black face anywhere for more than 2 days, and he now realized, as they began chugging up the long hill, which eventually led to Harkness, that there were no black faces on the road this morning, no black people anywhere. From the houses in which they lived all along the road, no smoke curled, no life stirred. Maybe one or two chickens were to be seen, that was all. There was no one at the windows, no one in the yard, no one sitting on the porches, and the doors were closed. He had come this road many a time and seen women washing in the yard. There were no clothes on the clotheslines. Men working in the fields, children playing in the dust. Black men passed them on the road other mornings. Other days, on foot or in wagons, sometimes in cars, tipping their hats, smiling, joking, their teeth a solid white against their skin, their eyes as warm as the sun, the blackness of their skin like dull fire against the white or the blue or the gray of their torn clothes. They passed a nigger church, dead white, desolate, locked up, in the graveyard where no one knelt or walked, and he saw no flowers. He wanted to ask, Where are they? Where are they all? But he did not dare. As the hill grew steeper, the sun grew colder. He looked at his mother and his father. They looked straight ahead, seeming to be listening to the singing which echoed and echoed in this graveyard silence. They were strangers to him now. They were looking at something he could not see. His father's lips had a strange, cruel curve. He wet his lips from time to time and swallowed. He was terribly aware of his father's tongue. It was as though he had never seen it before. And his father's body suddenly seemed immense, bigger than a mountain. His eyes, which were gray-green, looked yellow in the sunlight, or at least there was a light in them which he had never seen before. His mother patted her hair and adjusted the ribbon, leaning forward to look into the car mirror. "You look all right," said his father, and laughed. "When that nigger looks at you, he's going to swear he throwed his life away for nothing. Wouldn't be surprised if he didn't come back to haunt you." And he laughed again. The singing now slowly began to cease, and he realized that they were nearing their destination. They had reached a straight, narrow, pebbly road with trees on either side. The sunlight filtered down on them from a great height as though they were underwater, and the branches of the trees scraped against the cars with a tearing sound. To the right of them and beneath them, invisible now, lay the town, and to the left, miles of trees which led to the high mountain range which his ancestors had crossed in order to settle in this valley. Now all was silent except for the bumping of the tires against the rocky road, the sputtering of motors, and the sound of a crying child. And they seemed to move more slowly. They were beginning to climb again. He watched the cars ahead as they toiled patiently upward, disappearing into the sunlight of the clearing. Presently he felt their vehicle also rise, heard his father's changed breathing, the sunlight hit his face, the trees moved away from them, and they were there. As their car crossed the clearing, he looked around. There seemed to be millions. There were certainly hundreds of people in the clearing, staring towards something he could not see. There was a fire. He could not see the flames, but he smelled the smoke. Then they were on the other side of the clearing, among the trees again. His father drove off the road and parked the car behind a great many other cars. He looked down at Jesse. "You all right?" he asked. "Yes, sir," he said. "Well, come on, then," his father said. He reached over and opened the door on his mother's side. His mother stepped out first. They followed her into the clearing. At first he was aware only of confusion, of his mother and father greeting and being greeted, himself being handled, hugged, and patted, and told how much he had grown. The wind blew the smoke from the fire across the clearing into his eyes and nose. He could not see over the backs of the people in front of him. The sounds of laughing and cursing and wrath and something else rolled into waves from the front of the mob to the back. Those in front expressed their delight at what they saw, and this delight rolled backwards, wave upon wave, across the clearing, more acrid than the smoke. His father reached down suddenly and sat Jesse on his shoulders. Now he saw the fire of twigs and boxes piled high, flames made pale orange and yellow and thin as a veil under the steadier light of the sun. Gray-blue smoke rolled upward and poured over their heads. Beyond the shifting curtain of fire and smoke, he made out first only a length of gleaming chain attached to a great limb of the tree. Then he saw that this chain bound two black hands together at the wrist, dirty yellow palm facing dirty yellow palm. The smoke poured up. The hands dropped out of sight. A cry went up from the crowd. Then the hands slowly came into view again, pulled upward by the chain. This time he saw the kinky, sweating, bloody head. He had never before seen a head with so much hair on it, hair so black and so tangled that it seemed like another jungle. The head was hanging. He saw the forehead, flat and high, with a kind of arrow of hair in the center, like he had, like his father had. They called it a widow's peak, and the mangled eyebrows, the wide nose, the closed eyes, and the glinting eyelashes and hanging lips, all streaming with blood and sweat. His hands were straight above his head, all his weight pulled downward from his hands, and he was a big man, a bigger man than his father, and black as an African jungle cat, and naked. Jesse pulled upward. His father's hands held him firmly by the ankles. He wanted to say something. He did not know what. But nothing he said could have been heard, for now the crowd roared again as a man stepped forward and put more wood on the fire. The flames leapt up. He thought he heard the hanging man scream, but he was not sure. Sweat was pouring from the hair in his armpits, poured down his sides, over his chest, into his navel and his groin. He was lowered again. He was raised again. Now Jesse knew that he heard him scream. The head went back, the mouth wide open, blood bubbling from the mouth. The veins of the neck jumped out. Jesse clung to his father's neck in terror as a cry rolled over the crowd. The cry of all the people rose to answer the dying man's cry. He wanted death to come quickly. They wanted to make death wait, and it was they who held death, now, on a leash which they lengthened little by little. What did he do? Jesse wondered. What did the man do? What did he do? But he could not ask his father. He was seated on his father's shoulders, but his father was far away. There were two older men, friends of his father's, raising and lowering the chain. Everyone indiscriminately seemed to be responsible for the fire. There was no hair left on the nigger's privates, and the eyes now were wide open, as white as the eyes of a clown or a doll. The smoke now carried a terrible odor across the clearing, the odor of something burning, which was both sweet and rotten. He turned his head a little and saw the field of faces. He watched his mother's face. Her eyes were very bright. Her mouth was open. She was more beautiful than he had ever seen her, and more strange. He began to feel a joy he had never felt before. He watched the hanging, gleaming body, the most beautiful and terrible object he had ever seen till then. One of his father's friends reached up, and in his hands he held a knife, and Jesse wished that he had been that man. It was a long, bright knife, and the sun seemed to catch it, to play with it, to caress it. It was brighter than the fire. And a wave of laughter swept the crowd. Jesse felt his father's hands on his ankles slip and tighten. The man with the knife walked toward the crowd, smiling slightly, as though this were a signal. Silence fell. He heard his mother cough. Then the man with the knife walked up to the hanging body. He turned and smiled again. Now there was a silence over the field. The hanging head looked up. It seemed fully conscious now, as though the fire had burned out terror and pain. The man with the knife took the nigger's privates in his hand, one hand, still smiling as though he were weighing them. In the cradle of the one white hand, the nigger's privates seemed as remote as meat being weighed on the scales, but seemed heavier, too, much heavier. And Jesse felt his scrotum tighten, and huge, huge, much bigger than his father's, flaccid, hairless, the largest thing he had ever seen till then, and the blackest. The white hand stretched them, cradled them, caressed them. Then the dying man's eyes looked straight into Jesse's eyes. It could not have been as long as a second, but it seemed longer than a year. Then Jesse screamed, and the crowd screamed as the knife flashed, first up and then down, cutting the dreadful thing away, and the blood came roaring down. Then the crowd rushed forward, tearing at the body with their hands, with knives and with rocks, with stones, howling and cursing. Jesse's head, of its own weight, fell downwards towards his father's head. Someone stepped forward and drenched the body with kerosene. Where the man had been, a great sheet of flame appeared. Jesse's father lowered him to the ground. "Well, I told you," said his father, "you wasn't never going to forget this picnic." His father's face was full of sweat. His eyes were very peaceful. At that moment, Jesse loved his father more than he had ever loved him. He felt that his father had carried him through a mighty test, had revealed to him a great secret which would be the key to his life forever. "I reckon," he said, "I reckon." Jesse's father took him by the hand, and with his mother, a little behind them, talking and laughing with the other women, they walked through the crowd across the clearing. The black body was on the ground. The chain which had held it was being rolled up by one of his father's friends. Whatever the fire had left undone, the hands and the knives and the stones of the people had accomplished. The head was caved in. One eye was torn out. One ear was hanging. But one had to look carefully to realize this, for it was, now merely, a black charred object on the black charred ground. He lay spread-eagled with what had been a wound between what had been his legs. "They're going to leave him here, then," Jesse whispered. "Yeah," said his father. "They'll come and get him by and by. I reckon we better get over there and get some of that food before it's all gone." "I reckon," he muttered now to himself, "I reckon." Grace stirred and touched him on the thigh. The moonlight covered her like glory. Something bubbled up in him. His nature again returned to him. He thought of the boy in the cell. He thought of the man in the fire. He thought of the knife and grabbed himself and stroked himself, and a terrible sound, something between a high laugh and a howl, came out of him and dragged his sleeping wife up on one elbow. She stared at him in a moonlight which had now grown cold as ice. He thought of the morning and grabbed her, laughing and crying, crying and laughing, and he whispered as he stroked her, as he took her, "Come on, sugar, I'm going to do you like a nigger, just like a nigger. Come on, sugar, and love me just like you'd love a nigger." He thought of the morning as he labored and she moaned, thought of morning as he labored harder than he ever had before. And before his labors had ended, he heard the first cock crow and the dogs begin to bark and the sound of tires on the gravel road. And that story was Going to Meet the Man by James Baldwin from Vintage Short Fiction, Volume 1, edited by David Madden. The next story is from the same book, Araby by James Joyce. North Richmond Street, being blind, was a quiet street except at the hour when the Christian Brothers School set the boys free. An uninhabited house of two stories stood at the blind end, detached from its neighbors in a square ground. The other houses of the street, conscious of decent lives within them, gazed at one another with brown, imperturbable faces. The former tenant of our house, a priest, had died in the back drawing room. Air, musty from having been long enclosed, hung in all the rooms, and the waste room behind the kitchen was littered with old useless papers. Among these I found a few paper-covered books, the pages of which were curled and damp. The Abbot by Walter Scott, The Devout Communicant, and the Memoirs of Vigdok. I liked the last best because its leaves were yellow. The wild garden behind the house contained a central apple tree and a few straggling bushes, under one of which I found the late tenant's rusty bicycle pump. He had been a very charitable priest. In his will, he had left all his money to institutions and the furniture of his house to his sister. When the short days of winter came, dusk fell before we had well eaten our dinners. When we met in the street, the houses had grown somber. The space of sky above us was a color of ever-changing violet, and towards it the lamps of the street lifted their feeble lanterns. The cold air stung us, and we played till our bodies glowed. Our shouts echoed in the silent street. The career of our play brought us through the dark, muddy lanes behind the houses where we ran the gauntlet of the rough tribes from the cottages to the back doors of the dark, dripping gardens where odors arose from the ash pits, to the dark, odorous stables where a coachman smoothed and combed the horse or shook music from the buckled harness. When we returned to the street, light from the kitchen windows had filled the areas. If my uncle was seen turning the corner, we hid in the shadow until we had seen him safely housed. Or if Mangan's sister came out on the doorstep to call her brother in to his tea, we watched her from our shadow peer up and down the street. We waited to see whether she would remain or go in, and if she remained, we left our shadow and walked up to Mangan's steps resignedly. She was waiting for us, her figure defined by the light from the half-open door. Her brother always teased her before he obeyed, and I stood by the railings looking at her. Her dress swung as she moved her body, and the soft rope of her hair tossed from side to side. Every morning I lay on the floor in the front parlor watching her door. The blind was pulled down to within an inch of the sash so that I could not be seen. When she came out on the doorstep, my heart leaped. I ran to the hall, seized my books, and followed her. I kept her brown figure always in my eye, and when we came near the point at which our ways diverged, I quickened my pace and passed her. This happened morning after morning. I had never spoken to her except for a few casual words, and yet her name was like a summons to all my foolish blood. Her image accompanied me even in places the most hostile to romance. On Saturday evenings, when my aunt went marketing, I had to go to carry some of the parcels. We walked through the flaring streets, jostled by drunken men and bargaining women, amid the curses of laborers, the shrill litanies of shop boys who stood guard by the barrels of pig's cheeks, the nasal chanting of street singers who sang, Come All You About O'Donovan Rossa, or a ballad about the troubles in our native land. These noises converged in a single sensation of life for me. I imagined that I bore my chalice safely through a throng of foes. Her name sprang to my lips at moments in strange prayers and praises which I myself did not understand. My eyes were often full of tears, I could not tell why, and at times a flood from my heart seemed to pour itself out into my bosom. I thought little of the future. I did not know whether I would ever speak to her or not, or if I spoke to her, how I could tell her of my confused adoration. But my body was like a harp, and her words and gestures were like fingers running upon the wires. One evening, I went into the back drawing room in which the priest had died. It was a dark, rainy evening, and there was no sound in the house. Through one of the broken panes, I heard the rain impinge upon the earth, the fine, incessant needles of water playing in the sodden beds. Some distant lamp or lighted window gleamed below me. I was thankful that I could see so little. All my senses seemed to desire to veil themselves, and, feeling that I was about to slip from them, I pressed the palms of my hands together until they trembled, murmuring, O love, many times. At last she spoke to me. When she addressed the first words to me, I was so confused that I did not know what to answer. She asked me if I was going to Araby. I forget whether I answered yes or no. It would be a splendid bazaar, she said. She would love to go. And why can't you? I asked. While she spoke, she turned a silver bracelet round and round her wrist. She could not go, she said, because there would be a retreat that week in her convent. Her brother and two other boys were fighting for their caps, and I was alone at the railings. She held one of the spikes, bowing her head towards me. The light from the lamp opposite our door caught the white curve of her neck, lit up her hair that rested there, and, falling, lit up the hand upon the railing. It fell over one side of her dress and caught the white border of a petticoat, just visible as she stood at ease. "It's well for you," she said. "If I go," I said, "I will bring you something." What innumerable follies laid waste my waking and sleeping thoughts after that evening. I wished to annihilate the tedious intervening days. I chafed against the work of school. At night in my bedroom and by day in the classroom, her image came between me and the page I strove to read. The syllables of the word Araby were called to me through the silence in which my soul luxuriated and cast an eastern enchantment over me. I asked for leave to go to the bazaar on Saturday night. My aunt was surprised and hoped it was not some Freemason affair. I answered few questions in class. I watched my master's face pass from amiability to sternness. He hoped I was not beginning to idle. I could not call my wandering thoughts together. I had hardly any patience with the serious work of life, which, now that it stood between me and my desire, seemed to me child's play, ugly, monotonous child's play. On Saturday morning, I reminded my uncle that I wished to go to the bazaar in the evening. He was fussing at the hall stand, looking for the hat brush, and answered me curtly, "Yes, boy, I know." As he was in the hall, I could not go into the front parlor and lie at the window. I left the house in bad humor and walked slowly towards the school. The air was pitilessly raw, and already my heart misgave me. When I came home to dinner, my uncle had not yet been home. Still, it was early. I sat staring at the clock for some time, and when its tickings began to irritate me, I left the room. I mounted the staircase and gained the upper part of the house. The high, cold, empty, gloomy rooms liberated me, and I went from room to room singing. From the front window, I saw my companions playing below in the street. Their cries reached me weakened and indistinct, and, leaning my forehead against the cool glass, I looked over at the dark house where she lived. I may have stood there for an hour, seeing nothing but the brown-clad figure cast by my imagination, touched discreetly by the lamplight on the curved neck, at the hand upon the railings, and at the border below the dress. When I came downstairs again, I found Mrs. Mercer sitting at the fire. She was an old garrulous woman, a pawnbroker's widow, who collected used stamps for some pious purpose. I had to endure the gossip of the tea-table. The meal was prolonged beyond an hour, and still my uncle did not come. Mrs. Mercer stood up to go. She was sorry she couldn't wait any longer, but it was after 8 o'clock, and she did not like to be out late, as the night air was bad for her. When she had gone, I began to walk up and down the room, clenching my fists. My aunt said, "I'm afraid you may put off your bazaar for this night of our Lord." At 9 o'clock, I heard my uncle's latchkey in the hall door. I heard him talking to himself and heard the hall stand rocking when it had received the weight of his overcoat. I could interpret these signs. When he was midway through his dinner, I asked him to give me the money to go to the bazaar. He had forgotten. "The people are in bed and after their first sleep now," he said. I did not smile. My aunt said to him energetically, "Can't you give him the money and let him go? You've kept him late enough as it is." My uncle said he was very sorry he had forgotten. He said he believed in the old saying, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy." He asked me where I was going, and when I had told him a second time, he asked me, did I know the Arab's farewell to his steed? When I left the kitchen, he was about to recite the opening lines of the piece to my aunt. I held a florin tightly in my hand as I strode down Buckingham Street towards the station. The sight of the streets thronged with buyers and glaring with gas recalled to me the purpose of my journey. I took my seat in a third-class carriage of a deserted train. After an intolerable delay, the train moved out of the station slowly. It crept onward among the ruinous houses and over the twinkling river. At Westland Row Station, a crowd of people pressed to the carriage doors, but the porters moved them back, saying that it was a special train for the bazaar. I remained alone in the bare carriage. In a few minutes, the train drew up beside an improvised wooden platform. I passed out onto the road and saw by the lighted dial of the clock that it was 10 minutes to 10. In front of me was a large building which displayed the magical name. I could not find any sixpenny entrance, and fearing that the bazaar would be closed, I passed in quickly through a turnstile, handing a shilling to a weary-looking man. I found myself in a big hall girdled at half its height by a gallery. Nearly all the stalls were closed, and the greater part of the hall was in darkness. I recognized a silence like that which pervades a church after a service. I walked into the center of the bazaar timidly. A few people were gathered about the stalls, which were still open. Before a curtain over which the words Café Chantant were written in colored lamps, two men were counting money on a salver. I listened to the fall of the coins. Remembering with difficulty why I had come, I went over to one of the stalls and examined porcelain vases and flowered tea sets. At the door of the stall, a young lady was talking and laughing with two young gentlemen. I remarked their English accents and listened vaguely to their conversation. "Oh, I never said such a thing." "Oh, but you did." "Oh, but I didn't." "Didn't she say that?" "Yes, I heard her." "Oh, there's a fib." Observing me, the young lady came over and asked me, did I wish to buy anything? The tone of her voice was not encouraging. She seemed to have spoken to me out of a sense of duty. I looked humbly at the great jars that stood like Eastern guards at either side of the dark entrance to the stall and murmured, "No, thank you." The young lady changed the position of one of the vases and went back to the two young men. They began to talk of the same subject. Once or twice, the young lady glanced at me over her shoulder. I lingered before her stall, though I knew my stay was useless, to make my interest in her wares seem the more real. Then I turned away slowly and walked down the middle of the bazaar. I allowed the two pennies to fall against the sixpence in my pocket. I heard a voice call from one end of the gallery that the light was out. The upper part of the hall was now completely dark. Gazing up into the darkness, I saw myself as a creature driven and derided by vanity, and my eyes burned with anguish and anger. And that story was Araby by James Joyce from Vintage Short Fiction, Volume 1, edited by David Madden. The last story is from Flash Fiction, edited by James Thomas, Denise Thomas, and Tom Hazuka. The Restraints by Robert Hill Long. Even when she was very little, her hunger was worth something. Hunger taught her to dance, and her father noticed. When his thirst was deep enough, he could charm any bartender into clearing the narrow bar for just one dance. See, a girl, and feet so tiny. The patrons would shout for a second dance when they saw how the drumbeat of her bare feet could start such a trembling among the bottles on shelves. By the third or fourth dance, the trembling reached the glasses in their hands. They threw coins and bills at her feet to make her stop. Then her father would let her climb down and be a little girl again, mumbling thanks in poor English for the chair and spoon and bowls of stew brought her by drunken bricklayers and stevedores. Afterwards, under the stars of whatever field they slept in, she'd dream the same dream, dancing in a dress with ruffles, polka dots. Some nights, still asleep, she'd rise and wander. Once she woke in the middle of a dirt road. An armadillo sniffed her. A train blew in the distance. Another time she woke on the porch of an old white couple. Her English was so poor they guessed she was deaf-mute. They bathed and fed her, aimed to adopt her. She was trying on a dress with blue dots in front of their radio full of Bing Crosby when her father knocked on the screen door. He made her choose between the dress and him. To protect his livelihood after that, he tied a rope from her ankle to his ankle at night. If she rose to leave, she fell. It is many dances later now, many dresses, many men later. The nurses who are otherwise kind tie her old lady wrists down so she cannot rip out the IV again. Some nights her feet drum against the footboard, but weakly. When she can forget the restraints, she goes over memories step by step. The time she was caught dancing in a bar at age 10 and jailed for 3 days. Emerging, she saw her father at the corner holding his hat, which meant he was ashamed of himself. Out of his jacket, he drew the most beautiful loaf of bread, which she ate before allowing him to kiss her. She remembers a night her stitched-up knee opened on stage in Chicago. With every spin, she flung blood onto the front row gowns and tuxedos. By then, even her blood was famous. But sometimes, when she was 10, 12, dancing in those bars, she would not stop, not even after her father's guitar stopped. She made the coins at her feet tremble and spin, kicked the sweaty dollar bills back at the drinkers and shouters. Having the moment, that was having everything. When she closes her eyes now, she knows who it is, tied to her on the narrow bed. And that story was Restraints by Robert Hill Long from Flash Fiction, edited by James Thomas, Denise Thomas, and Tom Hazuka. And that's the end of our classic short stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me.